welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 227 of the podcast. And it's 25th of July, 2015, as I record this. So today we have an interview with Charles Harris on the importance of genre and honing your elevator pitch. And yes, it's based around screenwriting tips, but even if you don't write fiction, you should find it interesting around the importance of the one-liner in selling your book or your brand or your business. And in fact, this kind of tagline idea is something I'm really fascinated in at the moment. But before we get into the interview, I have some really big news and I'm super excited to tell you about this. The Creative Pen business is now a six-figure business and I'm actually hiring my husband out of his corporate job to work with me. And this is very exciting in many ways and it's been a big financial goal for a number of years. And it also means I will be able to serve you guys more and the sort of growing audience of authors on the Creative Pen and on the podcast, because I will have more help, which let's face it, we all need. I can continue to write books and also blog and do the podcast, but I can also do courses and I'm planning to build a more intimate community of writers who want to take things to the next level, which again, I'm super excited about because I've been going through the over 2,000 questions from the survey that I did on the Creative Pen a few months ago. And thanks if you joined in that survey, it's super useful. And there are so many questions about how to actually make some money with writing and with books. And of course, that's why I wrote How to Make a Living with Your Writing, which has been number one in authorship for nearly a month and in the top 10 books on entrepreneurship, and also Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur, which continues to sell well. And I've also been running live events on the topic of making a living with your writing, and they've been really popular. But the thing is, they're obviously in London, and I know most of you are not in London. In fact, 99% of my audience on the podcast and the Creative Pen site is not in London. So I'm really keen to spread that wider. And clearly, this is information people want, and there really isn't much out there that actually teaches authors about making money. There's lots of craft stuff, but not much on the business side. So I'm working on something that will help you if you want to make a living with your writing and maybe you're frustrated that you're just not getting where you want to be as fast as you would like. But before I'm sort of working on that at the moment, but I'm starting off with some free video training. And yes, for all you audio fans, for all you listeners, there will be audio downloads as well. So you can listen in the car and you can find the first video, which is 11 ways to make money as an indie author at thecreativepen.com/freedom. That's thecreativepen.com/freedom. And 11 ways to make money as an indie author. I hope that gives you lots of good ideas. And please do share that link with any author friends who might be interested. And again, I'm super excited to be doing this. And I really hope this is useful to you. I'm very motivated by helping people sort of reach their financial goals. I think we just don't talk about it enough. But coming off of Thriller Fest a few weeks ago, where I was surrounded by, people who are quite happy talking about money, I'm determined to do more of that. Yes, we are artists, but it's very nice to earn a good living too, right? Okay, so here's the regular segment on what are you doing while listening to the show? Once again, with some awesome pictures. So L.E. Thomas, listening while jogging, and a family of deer came to join me. And he sent a picture of a deer running across the road, which is cool. He or she. L.E. is difficult to know. Tara Kwan, listening to your podcast on the way from work to the gym. This is where I refilled my water bottle. And Tara sent a picture of an old water pump in Rome, which is awesome. Sarah Rosette listening to the show while driving to the airport in Texas. A picture of the airport. I'm getting lots of pictures of traveling, which I like. Billy Grogan enjoyed listening to the latest show while driving on I-285 near Atlanta. And there's a picture of Billy in his police chief uniform. And I now have met three police chiefs who are on Twitter, which is quite cool. Paul Stevenson, listening as I set off to the daily grind, dosing up on inspiration that I hope will last until I get back to my laptop. A picture of Paul's dashboard in his car. And this is how I started listening to podcasts, was when I was commuting to the job I really didn't like too much. So happy to be in your ears if you're on the way to the day job. And Russell Phillips, listening to your podcast while organising research from a trip to the National Archives, and sent a picture of a really old folder with "most secret" stamped on it, which is very cool. Jan Vermeer, or Jan Vermeer, I don't know if you're from the Netherlands, Jan. Here's a picture of me listening to the podcast while taking the bike to the repair shop. And a nice bike there. MD Pittman sent me some road trip scenery. Very nice. Chris Creer, I think it's Creer, K-R-E-I-E. Hi, Chris. Started listening to the Creative Pen podcast yesterday. Listened to a couple of episodes while this morning on my bike ride. Loving it so far. Tim McGregor says, I listen to the podcast while making dinner for the missus and the kids. I often burn things because I'm busy taking notes. Awesome, Tim. I like that quite a lot. Tim also mentioned that he enjoyed the long-term and global perspective that Thad brought. And I have had quite a few comments about that last show. So I'm so glad that you guys like that. I do really want this podcast to be different to the other self-publishing podcasts in the market. Tim also said, I like your idea of making a Kobo exclusive box set. I stole your idea and I'm doing the same. Flattery by way of imitation. And the reason I mention that is because absolutely I want you guys to steal ideas. I mean, we know that Picasso said great artists steal. It's something that's so important. I mean, we should all be finding what is working for other people and modeling. I like to use the word modeling, which is better than stealing. But absolutely, my whole point is that you guys take these ideas and implement them yourself. So thanks for that, Tim. Okay, and of course, you can share what you're doing while listening to the show on Twitter. If you tweet me at the Creative Pen with a double N, or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, on writing news, just so you know, I am still writing. Deviance releases this week. The third in the London Psychic trilogy goes live on the 31st of July 2015 and is available in print as well as ebook format. Actually, the print is already live, which is quite funny, but the ebook goes up. It's on pre-order, but it will be live on the 31st of July. I also have a book bub this week on desecration. So if you are listening in the week or two after release, the last week in July, first week in August 2015, you can get all three books on special. Desecration is at 99 cent, down from 4.99, and Delirium and Deviance are at 2.99 instead of 4.99. So if you fancy trying out my crime thrillers with a supernatural edge, you can find them on all stores or jfpen.com, all the links, etc. So very excited about that. I'm really happy to have rounded up a trilogy and feels good. So, so today the podcast is sponsored by you guys. Big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And you can find everybody at thecreativepen.com/patrons if you want to see all the people supporting the show. And thanks especially to new patrons, Jolene Cazola, Kelly Dugan or Duggan, and Jessica Johansson or Johannesson. Isn't it so hard to get people's names right? So apologies if I've mangled them. And also thanks to everyone who's upped their pledge since I moved to a weekly show. That is awesome. And yeah, you can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you so much. Okay, so let's get on with the interview with Charles. Just to let you know, we did have a few Skype issues at the end. So the very last 5 minutes are on the phone, but the audio is still good. So there you go. And remember to check out the video and audio of 11 ways to make money as an indie author at thecreativepen.com/freedom. Here we go. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Charles Harris. Hi Charles.
Hi Joanna.
Good to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Charles is an international award-winning writer-director, a script consultant, co-founder of Euroscript Screenwriters Workshop, and author of The Complete Screenwriting Course, which is super exciting. But Charles, just tell us a bit more about the highlights of your writing career, because you've done so much.
Highlights. Well, I started off as a writer. I was always a director. I directed home movies and student movies. And the only problem was I needed scripts, and I couldn't afford to hire a writer who'd work for as little as I could afford to pay myself. So I basically hired myself, and then thought I'd better learn how to write. Back in those days, impossible as it may be to believe, there were no books on screenwriting. I mean, this was I think Sid Fields came out a few years later, and then McKee and so forth, and there are millions to which I've added my own, for better or for worse. But I got together with some other people. There was an organization called AIP, which became PACT, which is a major industry organization. Then was quite a small ginger group of people who are just trying to sort of build their careers. And met up with some writers there, and we formed a kind of a screenwriting workshop independently, and discovered we'd created the first screenwriters workshop in the world. So in fact, you slightly misrepresented me. I didn't found Euroscript. That was London Screenwriters Workshop, which became Screenwriters Workshop, which then spun off into Euroscript. A group of us actually founded Euroscript. Technically, although I'm the director of Euroscript, I didn't found it. But we are still the same ethos. The still industry people teaching industry people. Mm. And at the same time, I then moved on to writing, writing my own material more and more, and I've been very pleased with it. I've done work in just about every area: documentary, cinema, mostly directing and writing, occasionally only directing, occasionally writing, theatre, fringe theatre, and I've got my first novel coming out in the next spring, which is very exciting. And in fact, just delivered the polished draft to the back to the publisher after a few brief notes this morning.
Yeah, well, congratulations.
If I look sort of lighter and happier, I'm on holiday for about a minute.
I was going to say, that's, you know, the life of a writer is you finish one project and you start the next. I mean, you've always got stuff bubbling away. But I'm really interested in your work, as you know, you assess scripts. I've seen you at the London Screenwriters Festival. Mm-hmm. People are always pitching you stories, and you're like a script doctor and a story doctor, which makes you somebody who, you know, apart from reading books and watching films, you've gone through, I guess, so many stories over the years. And I wonder if you could maybe give us, what are the top three things you've seen that are critical for a script that sells or a story that resonates? So, and I don't mean literary works, I mean bestsellers type things.
When you say, I mean, you're talking about film scripts. I mean, to be honest, it applies to novels just as much, more and more the two are coming together. I think, I mean, the first has to be the premise. And this is where films and TV do differ slightly from novels and short stories, in that the premise is so much more important. As a novel, you can get away with a premise that's transcended by the quality of the writing to a large extent. Particularly if it's a name writer. with TV or film, you do have to have a really good fundamental idea that makes people want to sit up and say, yeah, I want to see that movie. I want to turn on that TV series. I want to buy a box set. The kind of the sort of the classic elevator pitch, if you like. Mm. So that's number one. I see the things that are written, and the fundamental idea is never going to run. People aren't going to, for one reason or another, and we can go into the reasons if you like, it doesn't, you know, it's not going to hold an audience. The second one is character. Characters I want to spend my time with, characters we want to spend our time with, and that certainly applies to novels too. In fact, when I was writing my screenwriting book, I spoke to my agent and said, "What, you know, what do you advise?" And he said, "You know, sort of the most crucial thing, par excellence, is a good central character. Doesn't mean you have to like them; they can be extraordinarily unlikable. But you want to spend time with them. They're exciting. They strike sparks. You want to find out what happens to them, and maybe stop them doing it, or support them doing it, or save them, or whatever. And the third." It's a kind of mixture of storytelling, tone, narrative. It's the fact that I'm being told a story. I see a lot of scripts which don't do that. They might be very well written, but somehow they don't give me a story I want to follow. And I think the third thing, particularly for screenplays, is that I am drawn into a story I want to know what happens, I want to be with, and obviously want to find out what happens at the end.
Right. So, and that, in a way, the kind of hooks of things that you want to find out, little things that you put in that your brain then wants to find out what happened.
That's part of technique, absolutely. Although that's, in a way, in a funny sort of way, less important than the overall tone. I mean, there's a, you know, when you start reading, you feel you're in the hands of somebody who who's weaving a yarn you want to be with, and that voice is enormously important. I think it's very underrated. Mm. And you feel comfortable, then yes, the hooks will happen and those things will happen. But funnily enough, often they're less important, or they happen automatically. I think the danger of doing it the other way around is it becomes almost like an intellectual problem that people sometimes got to have a hook here, got to have a hook here, and I've read this kind of scripts and they instantly boring. You know, because yeah. I'm not with someone I want to be with.
Mm, so that character is important. Can you just go back into premise? Because I think what happens in many of these things is we say words like premise and tone, and people don't know what that actually means in a concrete way. So can you give us like a concrete example of a premise?
Firstly, I'll explain a bit more. I mean, they're words like premise, pitch, logline, and tagline get thrown around. My view is they're all the same thing. They're basically your story. We talk about elevator pitch. You know, it's your story in one or two sentences. And the reason is very simple. It's not that sort of the industry has kind of been nasty to writers and say, well, I know you're finding it difficult enough to boil your, 70,000 word novel down to 90 pages of script, mostly white paper. Now we're saying you have to do it in two sentences or one sentence, preferably. There's a reason for this, which is the thing that sells movies and TV programs is word of mouth. You can spend as much as you like, spend millions on advertising, ultimately get you a good opening weekend if you're lucky. And then you get people telling each other, oh, I wouldn't go and see this, or yes, go and see that. So what you're doing when you pitch, when you're developing a premise, when you're talking to a producer, whatever you're doing, and I think the same applies to a large extent of novels as well, that it's more your area than mine, is you're thinking in terms of down the line, there are going to be someone standing by a bus stop or by the water cooler saying, you've got to read this book, you've got to see this movie, you've got to watch this TV series. And you've got about two sentences before they suddenly have a subsequent engagement and realize they've got to go somewhere else. You know, you don't have 90 minutes to do this thing that people imagine you do, saying, you know, the sun's rising over, you know, over the Creative Pen, you know, factory, and you've gone for 90 minutes and they say, and then, you know, Joanna strides out with a Kalashnikov over her shoulder, over the dead bodies having succeeded. And, you know, I mean, that's not really what you can do. So, Your premise, your pitch, I think the same thing. And it is boiling it down into a juicy, exciting sentence that people say, absolutely. Mm. That I can see there's an audience. I mean, initially, the producer thinking I can see there's an audience. You know, she's there to finance your family, and all the way down, the actors, the DOP, cameraman, you know, all those sort of people you have to get excited and on board till finally you get down to the people standing at the bus stop saying, you've got to go and see this movie or you've got to watch this TV program. So that's a long-winded, it's a very long-winded way of explaining one something that's actually very short.
Yeah, so...
this is something I teach. I mean, I have to say, I spend 2 days, a two-day workshop teaching it, so it's quite difficult to boil down.
Yes, I realise. Difficult to do on a podcast. But one example, I was just thinking of a friend of mine, A.G. Riddle, who has a book deal and film and everything. His is, a plane takes off and lands in the future.
Wow, I like that.
Yeah, so you don't need anything else. You don't need anything else, do you?
You would if you were pitching it to a producer.
Well, he got a Fox deal based on that one line.
Did he got a deal?
Oh yeah, it sold him movie rights. It sold, you know, he sold, but he has sold multi millions of books. Indie writer, yeah. But when he gave me that line, and he spent a long time coming up with that line. Mm. So I
would imagine, and obviously, that, I mean, that's a great initial pitch, because the pitch can mean different things to different people, and some people use the pitch as just the hook to draw people in. Unless you're an experienced writer with a big track record, a pitch anyway is not going to get you a deal. What is going to get you, the ideal, is either send me the script or tell me more. Mm. So if somebody said that to me, and I imagine what happened.
If they got the book.
Tell me more.
Yeah.
And then that leads you into starting to have a longer conversation, which is great. Mm. You see, what I advise, advise writers is to have a story sentence which gives you the gist, because what the producer's looking for is essentially, is there a story there? So if you pitch that, you know, the plane takes off and lands in the future, I say, great, yeah, but I'm still thinking, okay, who are the characters? What's their dilemma? Does this person know how to tell a story? No, he obviously does, because he's got a track record. Mm. So did you get what I'm saying?
Absolutely. That was really cool, and I think we're starting to get there, but I think everybody listening is going, well, I'm still not clear in how I actually write this line. So, take one of my books. I've got 70,000 words. I didn't start with a one-liner. How do I get from a book or, a novel into the one line? Is there a way of reverse engineering it?
Or even if you did start with one liner, I generally make sure I've got a premise before I start writing. Mm. And then rewrite it constantly. So it can work both ways. Yes, I mean, I do a very simple story sentence, and it's easy to describe, but although it takes a bit longer than we've probably got time in this podcast, so I'll give you the brief, introduction to it, so people can get their teeth stuck in, get stuck into it. But it's not, even though I teach it, I still find it tough to do, because you are getting to the gist of. And I listened to you talking on a recent podcast about social media, how difficult it is for the author to get to see it from the point of view of the reader. And it's a similar kind of thing. It is, you have to constantly see it from the other side. When you're in the middle of it, getting that perspective, it really takes feedback. I always advise people to bounce it off people, try it off people. So the story sentence is simply like this, and it might sound a bit like a formula, but I feel like a recipe, in that the ingredients, the good quality of the ingredients, are what you make it work. And the first thing is, I say, it just starts off, that's the first bit of the formula. So what do you got? Whenever someone looks upside, what do you got for me? It's a. And the next bit you put in is the genre. And the reason you put in the genre is because the genre tells you crucially what emotion you're getting and why you might want to go to it. I don't know about you, but most people decide whether they're going to see the movie or going to go to a TV or TV program very largely on, what do I feel like at the moment? Do I feel like comedy? Do I feel like a thriller? So if you don't know that, you're not even first base, because that's going to give you the fundamental emotion. So it's a comedy thriller, it's a supernatural horror detective story. And that's not always easy. Sometimes finding what your genre is can take a bit of work. And there's I'm happy to talk more on genre if you want
to. We'll come back to genre. Let's finish the sentence.
What I don't want to be is demeaning, because sometimes people think genre is somehow demeaning. Everything is a one thing or another. So even the greatest movies. Then you want to know who the protagonist is and what their goal is, because fundamental of all dramatic stories is somebody wanting to try and do something or trying to escape from something. So that's the outer story, in a sense. You say, it's a action-adventure story about a woman who's trying to escape from an indestructible homicidal robot. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Terminator. It's a romantic comedy about an actor who's finding it so difficult to get a job. The only way he can get a job is by dressing up as a woman and pretending to be an actress, which is Tootsie. Hmm. It's a coming-of-age story about a schoolgirl who becomes pregnant and has to try and find someone to take the baby, which is Juno.
Hmm.
Now, you notice you've not really got much of the gist of it yet. It's a very bare bones. It's not terribly exciting because what's missing is the inner story. And that's the bit that makes it come to life. So it's not just a protagonist, it's a certain kind of protagonist with a flaw. Yeah, so the Sarah Connor's flaw in Terminator is that she really isn't able to stand on her own two feet. She's being pushed around, and there's people in the, where she's working in the burger bar as a waitress, sticking ice cream down her apron, and she's not able to, she hasn't got the ability to, the balls to. About a woman who's unable to stand up for herself, who finds herself being chased by a homicidal, indestructible robot who's trying to kill everybody with her name.
Mm.
So, and then you just put a little bow on the end, sort of to tie it all off, an ironic twist that shows that she's had a kind of character journey, if she has. And by the end, she's more of a killing machine than the robot, you could say, for example. It's a romantic comedy about a bolshy, difficult, impossible actor who finds he can't get a job anywhere as an actor, so dressed up as a woman to go to get a job as an actress in a soap. And by the end, he finds that he's better man as a woman than he ever was as a man, which actually is a quote from the end of the script.
Ah.
And what's nice is it gets people smiling, because remember, it is a comedy, so we want people to really smile. You don't have to kind of... you don't have to fall about laughing. You don't have to be a stand-up comic. But something of your pitch, premise, whatever, I feel should have some of the emotion of your genre too. If you haven't chilled people with a horror pitch, then something's pretty gone wrong.
Mm. No, that's a great explanation. I'm interested then in how you would do a series sentence, because many indie authors write series because they sell better, and they once somebody's bought one in a series, they might carry on reading, and therefore you make more income. So most of us plot a multi-book arc. So how does, and of course there are many films that have sequels, but I guess they normally do that when it's already a success. But how would a series arc work with that? Because at the end, as you say, the end might be in the third book of the series.
Well, you've got two alternatives. One is, are you right in BBC terms? They used to call that series and serials. And a serial classically is one story told over a lot of
episodes. Most people write series, but there are people listening who will write serials.
So if you're doing a serial, it's one story. I just pitch the whole story, just be done with it. So essentially it's the same thing, it's just longer. Mm. I mean, the pitch isn't longer, but you need more oomph in it, more juice to make it last over a certain number of books or a number of films. That's simple. The series is a little bit more complicated. There, you need two premises. You've got your serious premise, which is the first thing you do. You say, it's a medical, a medical detective story about a doctor who's got a brilliant pathologist who has no human skills whatsoever relatable. And so you get the, that's the running gag, if you like, the running emotional hook, the character hook, which you turn on to House every week, because you've got that that character is interesting in himself. The fact that he's in this supposedly empathetic profession, and the irony is that he's totally unable to empathize. Mm. And then you then say something about what is going to happen every week, what people are going to turn on to. You say, well, and every week a new impossible to solve, disease comes in that he has to, through his brilliance, try to solve and cure the person. Mm. So that's how you picture a series like House. So you do, you know, what is, because a good series is based on at least, you know, usually as a what I call a constellation of characters all rubbing off on each other. Sometimes, like House, you've got one main character. Sometimes it's two or three, into, you know, like you know, it's a bit of a typical sitcom, all interfacing, treading on each other's toes. And you say, so you get the essence of what's going on there. And then you say, and each week, something like this happens. And then they'll probably say, well, give me a for instance. So then, and so you'd have to, if you're doing this on paper, because the same thing, exactly the same thing on paper. Say, for instance, you know, and then you basically do the premise for one of the episodes, usually your pilot episode. Mm,
okay.
This day, this particular thing comes in.
Yeah.
No, does that make sense?
No, that's great. So let's just go back to genre, because I explain genre to most people as, well, it's the Amazon category, you know, or it's the BSAT category on any of the stores, because we have to, when you publish, however you publish, your book has to go into a category, and we get two when we self-publish on an Amazon, but you get multiple categories on sites like iBooks, for example, or we can use keywords to get into categories. So what do you mean by genre, and how can people identify what they are?
Okay, well, you're not far off, and I mean, I've got a problem actually with my novel, because
we all have problems with cross-genre.
Well, yes, I mean, it's a crime novel of sorts, but it's also satire. And Amazon actually are great. They've got a category of a satire. But if you walk into a bookshop, like, you know, you, as you know, one is advised to do. In fact, I think you might even have put it in one of your excellent books on writing. Go into a bookshop and find out where they put things on the shelves. And you go into a particularly British bookshop, they don't know what satire is. No. They just don't have a category for it.
And I would say, just on that, satire, if you check the rankings, I would say that satire is not a great category for sales.
No.
So that's why
we're selling it as a crime.
Yeah, exactly. Put it in crime.
It's a kind of state of the nation crime story with a satirical element. And, you know, people will tell me, well, you've got to prove that you can, that it'll sell. And I'll say, well, let's hope that the readership does that.
Yeah.
Satire actually in TV and film is fine as a category. I mean, in a way, in a similar way to Amazon, it goes back to the shelves back in the 1920s and 30s, where the distributors would stack things on shelves saying Western, gangster, whatever. I mean, the word genre, if you know your French, just basically means kind of. Hmm. You know, what kind is, and that's what you're saying. And in a sense, we all know genre, because if I say what kind of, you know, I ask any book or any film, or anything, I say, what kind have you seen? What kind of is it? You'll tell me, you'll probably tell me six or seven different things. Hmm. You know, you'll say, well, it's a thriller, it's an action story, it's a kind of studio, you know, style, it's, you know, it's a bit epic. You know, there's a kind of a docudrama, you know, there's all sorts of things that go into it. The other problem with genre, one of the things, I mean, I have to say, genre is one of those words that's very difficult to talk about, particularly in the film industry, because there's this awful thing, and I think it happens in books too. There's this kind of, this sentence, which is, it's only a genre movie.
Mm.
You know, it's only a genre book. And I think that is dreadful, because that every kind of something.
Yeah, and also now, because if you describe it as category, literary fiction is a category on Amazon, so it's just as much a genre as anything else.
I mean, I've worked out the one category I couldn't cross over from film to novels is what we call drama, which classically was called melodrama, which is essentially about people interacting with people. Mm. And a lot of people write that sort of thing. And I worked out, I suspect literary fiction is the closest to that genre. It's, you know, it's drama. It's people relating to people rather than shooting each other or having, you know, running away from ghosts or whatever. And in fact, I've got I don't know if you know about shooting people. I've got a prize out on that. For those who don't know about shooting people, if you're interested in film and TV, you really have to join. It's a free mailing list. Well, it's not free. It's a very small amount of money. Mailing list with screenwriting and filmmaking categories and so forth. And it's a brilliant place to meet up. And I put out a few years back, I was having this discussion. I put up a competition. I said, look, if anyone can tell me of a film or TV program that isn't in a genre, they can have a bottle of champagne. I had to shell out the bottle. You know, the greatest movies, if you're talking about Hitchcock, if you're talking about Howard Hawks or Ford, or you're talking about Godard even, they all work in genres. In fact, the great, you know, Shakespeare worked in genres. The great writers are adept at using genre in very subtle and interesting ways.
Mm.
I think what we mean by only a genre book or movie is that it somehow hasn't quite risen above just being the genre. It's not that it is that anything else isn't genre, but you do get people thinking they can write outside of genre. And genre fundamentally comes down to, number one, emotion. We talked about it briefly already. You know, you go to a thriller because you want to be frightened.
Or thrilled.
Yeah. I'm a bit iffy about the word thrilled, because I think thrills tend to come with action and adventure movies. Thrills and spills.
I think frightened comes with horror, which I don't like.
See, this is a fascinating discussion. And when I'm teaching, I always say I'm not doing film studies. What I want to do is get people thinking for themselves. Because ultimately, we, the audience, are the experts in genre. It's what you mean by it as an audience that really counts. I mean, I would say horror horrifies. A good horror idea and a good horror film make you feel horrified. Now, it's interesting that a lot of horror films are also thrillers nowadays. But they weren't always. Some of the early horror films weren't thrillers. And you can still have horror films that aren't thrillers. But the a lot of them ones have, and in fact, I don't think you ever have one. You very rarely have a single genre movie, for reasons that we can discuss if you want, because you need to find variations. And so many horror films are thriller movies as well, and I think that's why you get the horror plus the fear factor. I think thriller is actually any other genre with the fear cranked up. It's a bit like, Spinal Tap, you turn up to 11. So you take another genre, normally horror or gangster or crime, occasionally noir, and you crank up the fear factor, that extra level of suspense. Similarly, so you go to a comedy, you want to laugh and so forth. That's step one. Then there's certain patterns you expect to deliver. So it's a lot of it's about expectation. And good writers understand it's about raising and surprising expectation. That's what genre is about.
Just going back, you mentioned a newsletter, but you didn't say where it was. Do you have a website?
The Shooting People newsletter. It's not mine. It's shootingpeople.org. But if you just put Shooting People into your favourite search engine, you'll find it, I'm sure.
Oh, fantastic.
And I can send you the details to put up on the, on your web. They're great. They're very good. And you get a regular, a daily bulletin.
Fantastic.
And there is actually one specifically for people who want to send in pictures as well. Bulletin just for that.
So I also wanted to ask you about this four quadrant thing, which I've heard about. So people say it's like a four quadrant movie or TV show, which therefore attracts all target markets. And I mean, I have two feelings towards this. One is, oh, that sounds great. And you can explain why that's good. But then equally, we're told to aim for a specific market so we don't just have something too generic. So what is the four quadrant idea, and when is it a good idea to try for that?
Okay, so four quadrants is essentially, we're talking about the market for a movie, which is and now excluding children's movies for the moment, we're talking about films for adults, not that kind of adult. So you've got, and essentially there are four markets for a movie, and a similar kind of breakdown for TV as well. It's slightly different, and the first is males between 40 and 24. Because they like going to movies, they like seeing movies with big bangs and big breasts. Basically, that's the sort of thing that attracts them.
Okay, cool.
They go to the multiplexes a lot, so often we're talking about a multiplex type movie here. They go to the cinema a lot. They're easily marketed to. If you're lucky, they drag the girlfriend along, and they also buy the two most profitable things in the universe. I don't know if you know what those are.
Beer and popcorn?
almost Coca-Cola and popcorn. Mm. Because you get a handful of popcorn and it costs a couple of pence if you're lucky, and sell it for whatever massive amount once you've puffed it up. That's what pays for movies. Movies don't make very little money out of the cinema. You're setting up an audience for TV and DVD and download and so forth. Okay, second quadrant. Second quadrant is women between 40 and 24, because they'll go with the boyfriends. They're a bit more discerning. They won't just go to anything, but they will go to the frequently to the movies. The third quadrant is males over 25. I'm afraid that's it. There is no other gradations. It's 35 and back, you know, to as old as you can get. And they're more discerning. They'll read reviews and they'll, and of course, they're generally in relationships by this point. So they're not going to go so often. And they have to get the babysitter in. And then there's the most difficult to get to of all is females 25 and above, because they don't even believe the reviews. You know, they're very discerning. They will only go to the things they're absolutely convinced they want to see. So what the interesting thing is that generally the first two, the younger ones, are the multiplex, the mainstream, and the old 25 tend to be the movies, but the more difficult they get to these, or they go to, you know, the art house specialist cinema route. So it takes a very special movie to kind of appeal to all four of those quadrants. And as you say, I think it is, you know, it's not only is it very difficult, it would be enormously foolish to try to design a movie for all of those. I mean,
I guess that's why the YA, like the YA films like Hunger Games, for example, fell squarely in that kind of market. And also Twilight, because they said that a lot of that, you know, younger women and older women also like that stuff. It's, so I mean, YA stuff, I think.
The other word that's used is crossover.
Yeah.
You know, you cross over from YA to like, you cannot predict that.
No.
You know, it's been the history of Hollywood, who are the best at it, is littered with people who thought they had a surefire crossover movie. The danger is you actually fall in a gap in the middle and you get what's called a tweener movie or on the bridge movie. I mean, I don't know if you saw my Big Fat Greek Wedding, for example. I
mean, no.
It's a lovely movie, but it kind of fits between the two. Because the thing is, independent specialist cinema movie is not just a multiplex movie that didn't work at the multiplexes. It has its own demands. You know, it has usually talking about it to be more stylish, more brave, more face, or off director led. It has a very special style to it, or something, or very political. There's things that the independent specialist cinema demands in the same way as, you know, obscure times on Channel 4, or which is the equivalent, I suppose you could say, or BBC Two.
So I guess with books, I mean, most readers are actually in that older market. I mean, most of our people listening, our readers will be over 25 actually, and the biggest reader market I think is women in their 40s and 50s, so that's actually completely different to movies. So should we actually not take any, you know, should we not try and compare movies and books, or how do they actually work together in that way then?
Depends how you mean by compare, because they are different things entirely.
Well, many, you know, like I mentioned, A.G. Riddle's book, for example, getting optioned. You know, many authors want to get a book optioned. But from what you're saying there, the audience is actually quite different. So should you just forget that kind of dream and just hope for, you know, luck? Or should we aim for that?
I mean, I either forget it or aim for it. The first thing you do is got to write a really good book. Because if a book that hasn't sold is unlikely to, it might be an option if it's got a really good idea, but it's not going to do a lot. I do advise a lot of my screenwriters to write a book or write for theatre. Theatre is also a very good place to develop your voice. We talked a bit about voice before, and I think voice is something that people often, you know, particularly the books, tend to ignore or kind of take as rare.
One of the questions I think people have, again, I think there's this myth or the dream that if you do amazingly get your book optioned and get made into a movie, that you make a gazillion dollars and like your life is made. And I wondered if you could potentially, you know, explain the reality of figures involved in, you know, TV and film and, you know, what it actually means to most writers.
Well, sitting here in my palatial Hampstead home, now, the reality is, no, I mean, it goes back to William Goldman's famous phrase, nobody knows anything. It could be anything. Every single contract is different. So the first thing, obviously, is to understand that it's a far more competitive market. I mean, novels are competitive enough, but you can at least self-publish. You can self-make films as well, but they're generally not for very much money. To give you an idea, when I first started the industry, there were 24 films made in this country each year. There's now about 240. On a good year, 300 odd, which is a massive increase. And then on top of that, there's thousands of scripts being written, thousands of scripts that people have ideas and never finish, thousands of scripts, you know, there's a lot of material there that we don't see, and we see the tiny tip of the iceberg, and it's an enormous amount of competition going on there. Now, you know, even 240, I mean, it's a lot by British, historically by British standards, is a tiny number compared to the number of books that are published each year. So filmmakers and TV makers tend to be understandably much more choosy. Also, they have a lot of money at stake. I'm not saying publishers don't have a lot of money at stake, but there's a lot at stake. And, a film that doesn't sell is not good for anybody. It kills careers. So they're looking for something they feel enormously solid about. And one of the sad things that saddens me is that publishers are beginning to go the same way, which means they don't take risks. And, of course, the most risky thing of all is not taking a risk.
Mm.
I'm trying to put all this in perspective. One way round it is to have published a book and to have shown it done well. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I mean, Harry Potter would not have been made into a film if it hadn't already had three major books behind it. The idea alone won't necessarily sell it. Having said that, some people do jump on a great book, jump on a great idea, and go with it. So assume you've got something that people like, or you found someone, and like anything, you've got to keep on going out and trying and trying and trying, because you'll get a lot of people saying no. When you get somebody, then there's a question of, like any negotiation, how much do you want it, how much do they want it? At one end of the scale, I've known people sell options for £1.
Mm.
You know, because they want it made, and that itself can be quite valuable for a career. Sometimes it's knowing what it is you want. You don't necessarily just want money. At the other end, I think Joe Esterhaz's, I think the script for Jagged Edge went for $1 million. That's just the option, not even the making of the film. That's just the agreement that says they have permission to raise the money and pay him for making it. Between the two, you have a sort of a ballpark of somewhere between about a few hundred and maybe 20,000 if you've got a fair bit of experience for a film script. The Writers Guild minimum for a first draft script is, I think, 14,000, 15,000. Mm. But again, it's, who wants what. Now, there's various stages of payment. You can get, the best one you get is what you mentioned, the option. In other words, someone pays you some money for a couple of years' worth of time, exclusive time, to raise the money to make the film, and then pays you a bit more, usually, for actually making the film. Usually the main chunk of money comes in what's called first day of principal photography, which is when you start filming. Then there's back-end money, points, percentages, which people hear about. The reality is, anyone who promises you anything out of the profits, you probably almost certainly will never see. Because most films don't make a profit, and if they do, the accountants manage to bury it in something else. Because they're all crooks. I mean, I always say, a producer has to be either a crook, a fool, or a charlatan. Because the film industry is such an impossible thing. You're building houses out of hot air. And if they're not a crook, you want to be a crook on your side as opposed to a crook on somebody else's side.
Yeah, well, that's why I asked this question, because I talked to somebody and they said, look, basically the films don't make money because it all gets shuffled around and people use films as investment vehicles and tax things, and as in, so I think the action for, well, not the, the recommendation for authors is, in any kind of negotiation around figures, make sure the money comes in, like you say, before it's made, and don't just sort of wait for the profits. But then the other side of that, of course, is didn't Alec Guinness take a percentage of Star Wars?
Yeah, something like 0.5% or something of, and I think he got it of the gross too. I mean, there's gross and net. Net means you can take all your costs off before paying the poor writer or actor. Gross is of the actual box office. But I mean, the thing is, both those films were so massive, such massive hits. In the end, they ran out of ways of hiding the money. I don't want to, I mean, when I say they're all crooks, of course, there are some good people in there as well. And I don't just say that because I want to work with them.
I think we all do.
I mean, it is a mad industry. I mean, if you think about it, if your job as a producer is to say to the writer, we're definitely going to be making it, to say to the star actor, don't worry, we've got the money to make it, so we want you to sign, and to say to the financiers, don't worry, the actor is signed before he actually has, you're a house of cards.
And then you hope it all comes together.
So if you don't lie at some point, you probably aren't able to make the film, because you know, because the finance won't come in until you've got Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise won't come in until you've got the finance. It's a mad, mad world.
And then maybe just comment on the time involved. So if a book is optioned, for example, how long before you see it on the screen? Or, you know, I've heard nightmare stories, but is there an average?
Next question. I mean, look, some films get done very quickly, but the reality is, if you option a book, the first thing you have to do, I mean, I'm assuming you haven't got the script written. That will probably take at least 2 years. To get it properly written. And the thing is, the film industry is a collaborative industry. I mean, the thing I'm getting used to in getting my novel published is actually I'm used to having thousands of notes. Many of them may be stupid, many of them may be enormously useful. And even the most edited book, I think, has far fewer than an average film does. So, you know, you've got to go through a number of drafts to get it. And the films go through a lot of drafts. Particularly if they're good films. I mean, Hollywood's very good at this. Here we tend to say seven drafts and we'll make it. In Hollywood, they say, here are seven drafts, we raise the money, now we rewrite it. And 14 drafts later we make it, which is one reason why their movies are so much more tight. So, you know, you're probably talking about 2 years to write the script, another year to start getting feedback on the finance, maybe another few rewrites. 5-6 years wouldn't be at all unusual. Sorry to depress you.
No, I think it's just good for people to realise the reality, because I think so many people, do want film options. And we've, you know, in the indie world, we've seen Hugh Howey with Wool has been optioned by Ridley Scott and A.G. Riddle, as I mentioned. And, you know, it's really awesome to hear these stories, but, you know, the likelihood is very small for most indie authors. So final question before we round up. So you've just turned in your novel, as you mentioned, you've written scripts, you look at a lot of script. So what have you learned in writing a novel? Is there anything that surprised you, given how much experience you have?
Well, it wasn't the first one I've written. Actually, it's the first one I've actually found a publisher for, and probably the second one I've actually sent out to a publisher. There's a couple of others that I would never, ever show my best friend. they're in lead-lined containers somewhere or other. So the first thing, I suppose, when I first started writing novels a long time ago, was just how big it is. It's a marathon compared to a sprint. Mm. And a lot of, I think the problem in reverse for a lot of people who are adapting or trying to move from novel screenwriting is just how little space there is. I mean, there's no room for maneuver in a script. Everything has to be enormously tight. It's like writing, I always say it's like writing haiku for 90 pages. Mm. There's nowhere to hide. You can't escape through a bit of purple prose. Not you can a lot for a novel, but you can. It's a little bit more forgiving. In that you, in a way, you can do the directing. I mean, what I loved about it is I'm like directing without having to deal with the producers and the finances. If I want it to snow, it snows. If I want 50,000 extras, I can just write them in. So that was great fun. So it was, you know, I mean, it's, and then I realized I actually still had to be quite judicious and I edited out a lot of the descriptions that I'd written in because they were fun to write. You still have to be quite tight and economical, but it's a different kind of economical. Mm. A lot of things very much, I think, the two can learn from each other. I think screenwriters ought to do more other kinds of writing. I think I said before, you know, theatre or novels or both, because they're much easier to develop your voice in. Because you can see it done. The thing with a film is, a film script is not a finished thing, it's a blueprint. Mm. And until it's actually made, you haven't really got the experience of the feedback. You get other kinds of feedback, and you need other kinds of feedback, but the actual seeing it on the screen, then you think, oh, that's what they meant. Yeah? So, a good place to do that is the short films, but also theatre, novels, short stories. So you can see something done, so you can kind of cut your teeth and move on. And I really enjoyed it. I think I found it great fun having much more space to spend with a character, because I talk about how important the characters, to really let a character rip over, I've been trying to cut it down, but it's still 90,000 words.
Ah, well, a lot of people like longer books.
I hope they do.
So give us can you give us the title so people can look out for it?
It's called The Breaking of Liam Glass.
Super. And you have books and courses available for people interested in screenwriting. So maybe just tell people where they can find all of those various resources.
The best place to go is my website, you can go from there to find the courses. Go to the Euroscript website. So I'm www.charles-harris, or dash if you're in a country that doesn't use the word hyphen, .co.uk.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.